You need a new fridge or maybe a washing machine. You go to Sears, right? Yeah, well, maybe not so fast on that, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 22nd of March. Glad to have you with us, everybody. We begin today not with a bang, but with a whimper. The apparent last gasp of a once iconic American company. And if you think I'm being hyperbolic here, it's not me, it's them. Sears said this in a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission this week. Quote, "Our historical operating results indicate substantial doubt exists related to the company's ability to continue as a going concern," end of quote. That's a very specific phrase there, going concern, with a specific meaning. In a nutshell, if you're not one, if you're not a going concern, the end may well be nigh. So with Sears having lost $2 billion last year and having been, shall we say, troubled for far, far longer than that, where might hope lie? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra starts us off.
Sears has a basic accounting problem. The company has a lot of bills, pensions, taxes, salaries, but with store sales down more than 7% last year, it may run out of cash. James O'Rourke, who teaches at the University of Notre Dame, says that could happen soon.
I would suspect that within 90 to 120 days, they will reach a point at which they can't make payroll and they cannot pay their most basic bills.
In that worst-case scenario, you'd probably see Sears file for bankruptcy. The company's disclosure that it has doubts about its future makes that seem inevitable. But Robert Roston from Training the Street, which provides financial education to bankers, says the reaction to the announcement is overblown.
There's concern here, but it's nothing today that didn't exist yesterday.
He says the Sears disclosure is the result of an accounting rule that just went into effect. It requires a company to report if it thinks its future might be in peril during the next year. He says we should see this statement as the company saying bankruptcy is a possibility.
But bankruptcy is not something we're planning for. We're planning on turning this around.
That would probably mean selling off assets to pay down debt. Greg Portell at A.T. Kearney says that's not a long-term solution for Sears.
Even if they're able to find more assets to sell or find more creative financing, they still don't have a revenue and a cash engine to turn the ship around.
He says a real turnaround would mean getting customers back into stores. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
According to the good people at Gallup, more than 40% of American workers now spend at least part of their time working remotely. That is, not alongside their colleagues. One company that was a pioneer of telecommuting is now having second thoughts about the whole thing. Many employees at IBM have been given a choice. Come work at an office in one of six cities, Atlanta, Raleigh, Austin, Boston, San Francisco, or New York, or you can leave. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
In 2009, about 40% of IBM's 386,000 employees worked outside of a traditional office. For good reason, says Chuck Wilsker. As president of the Telework Coalition, he's an evangelist for working remotely.
Productivity goes up, turnover goes down, recruitment goes up. We found in studies that an employer can save as much as $20,000 per year per employee.
Largely from reduced office space. But IBM has been losing revenue for 19 straight quarters. And as tech site The Register first reported, the company's new marketing chief wants her staff to work shoulder to shoulder. David Johnson, an analyst with Forrester Research, has been working remotely for 20 years. He says IBM risks losing a lot of good people.
What they're implicitly saying, without saying it, is that your needs and what you think don't matter as much as what we think. And that's not necessarily healthy.
But research suggests some combination of working shoulder to shoulder and alone might work best. Jim Harder, chief scientist with Gallup, has been looking at how engaged employees are when they work remotely.
Those who work none of the time or 100% of the time actually have the lowest levels of engagement. But those who work from 60 to 80% of their time remotely had the highest.
A lot depends on the job and how well bosses manage their remote workers. But he says the best compromise might be working 3 to 4 days away from the office and the rest of the time on site. Working remotely from Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
That is true. She did indeed. Sears closed down 12% today. The rest of Wall Street couldn't quite decide what it wanted. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to pick up now with a series we're doing this week about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, what it did and didn't do to and for the U.S. economy. First, though, quick piece of tape to set the scene for how NAFTA is usually discussed.
NAFTA was the worst trade deal in the history. It's like the history of this country.
Not only did I oppose NAFTA, I stood on picket lines with workers in opposition to this disastrous trade agreement.
Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders campaign 2016, obviously. So bearing those words in mind, here are some more from Marketplace's Sabri Benishore about what NAFTA did and didn't do to American jobs.
One thing that NAFTA is probably not is the big deal many people make it out to be.
For the U.S., you know, NAFTA mattered, but it wasn't a transformational thing. It has an outsized importance in the U.S. debate about trade policy relative to its actual economic impact.
Gordon Hansen is at UC San Diego. When Mexico entered NAFTA, its economy was the size of Ohio's.
So freeing trade with Ohio is a thing that economists would argue is good on net for the United States, but it's not transformational.
Economists estimate that since NAFTA was passed in 1994, it raised U.S. GDP by 0.5 to 1%. 0.5 to 1% in 23 years. We talk so much about NAFTA, Hansen says, because it's become a symbol of globalization.
NAFTA's got blame for stuff that it in no way could have been at fault for.
So a good example of this is fabric and clothes. As part of NAFTA, the U.S. made a deal with Mexico. It said, listen, we're going to drop barriers on Mexican clothes if you use American fabric to make them. So that way, Mexico, you'll get jobs stitching fabric together to make clothes. The U.S. will get jobs making fabric.
Fabric production in the United States rose substantially after NAFTA.
Noel Maurer teaches international affairs at George Washington University.
But jobs continued to decline because automation was wiping out jobs.
So here's NAFTA promoting a U.S. industry, but those jobs go to robots. Not really NAFTA's fault. And on the Mexican side, Mexico was all ready to start stitching up a storm.
And instead, a lot of the expected benefits from NAFTA for Mexico went away because China suddenly entered the world market.
China took those stitching jobs. Again, nothing to do with NAFTA. So much else that affects jobs has happened since NAFTA was passed. Mexico had a peso crisis, making Mexican exports cheaper. There have been two recessions and growth surges. Manufacturing in the U.S. grew by 250,000 jobs after NAFTA just because the economy was booming. Trying to figure out NAFTA's role, especially when it comes to job creation and job loss, is pretty hard.
People fight about that all the time.
Estimates are all over the place, though most say the net number of jobs lost is very low.
Putting that together into a ledger is really, really hard. I don't know of any that are really credible.
So in the end, NAFTA probably had very little impact in terms of total number of jobs. So what did NAFTA do? Like, what can we point to say, okay, NAFTA did this?
NAFTA helped the U.S. auto industry survive.
Again, Gordon Hansen.
The U.S. auto industry designed a very efficient production network that spanned the U.S., Mexico, and Canada.
Cars and car parts are no longer just made in the U.S. They're made across multiple borders extremely efficiently,
allowing the U.S. to compete more effectively with the rapidly growing and improving auto industries in Europe and Asia.
Same thing for aerospace. Other industries did not do so great when they were exposed to competition from Mexico. Apparel, rug making, brick making. Here's Noel Maurer.
These are industries that we generally don't think about when we think about the United States as an advanced industrial economy, but they provided a lot of jobs.
So when you look at the industries helped and harmed by NAFTA, the confusion over the jobs numbers starts to make more sense. Josh Bivens is with the Economic Policy Institute.
I think we can say with a lot of assurance that we have a different mix of employment because of NAFTA.
We lost low-skilled jobs for non-college-educated Americans in rugs or furniture making or brick making. We gained design and business services jobs in autos and aerospace.
That change in the mix of employment has been generally not good for non-college labor in the United States.
Then again, neither has automation, the move to a services-based economy, the decline of labor unions, globalization generally. So what did NAFTA do? Well, created jobs, he cut jobs, and gave people a name for their frustrations, deserved or not. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace. Coming up.
You know, Mr. Trump is saying about regulation? Well, NAFTA is going to kill that.
A shot of reality from a businessman who needs NAFTA. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 6 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 20,661. Did the blue chips, the NASDAQ, up 27 points, about a 0.5%, 58.21. The S&P 500 up 4 points, about 0.2%, 23.48. Utilities and other high dividend stocks rose as bond yields fell. Duke Energy up 1%. American Electric Power sparked up 0.2%. Sportswear giant Nike nicked off 7%. Late yesterday, the company posted fiscal third quarter sales that missed expectations. Rival firm Under Armour up about 0.5%. Adidas, or Adidas, if you're in Germany, took off 0.9%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.40% or just 2.4%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, it's Kai Ryssdal.
And I'm Molly Wood.
If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on Marketplace every day,
technology, the economy, culture, check out our weekly podcast, Make Me Smart. It's a chance to tell us the things you really want to learn more about and share with us the things you know more about than anyone else.
We're at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Ryssdal. Molly is at Molly Wood. Check it out. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The championship game of the World Baseball Classic is happening tonight just up the road from us here in downtown Los Angeles at Dodger Stadium. The United States has made the finals for the first time, and they're playing against a team that you might call a relative, maybe a cousin or something. It's Puerto Rico. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports this game tonight is a way for Puerto Ricans on the island and on the mainland to focus on something positive for a change.
At a restaurant in North Hollywood called Mofongos, Puerto Ricans eat native food and talk in Spanish. Today, it's all about baseball. Frank Villanueva drove 13 hours from Salt Lake City just for the game. He migrated to the mainland 4 years ago. He says he was tired of the crime and tired of the government running out of money to fund things like hospitals and schools. But today, he says every Puerto Rican can forget the territory's problems and celebrate the game.
La noticia ya lo que se oye todo es el juego.
All the news we're hearing about today is on the game, he tells me. You don't have to hear about somebody being murdered or somebody getting mugged. The Puerto Rican Tourism Board wants people watching the game to talk about visiting the island. It bought ads on the Major League Baseball Network. The slogan? A world-class team for a world-class island. Tourism brings Puerto Rico about $4 billion a year. Rafael Cox Alomar teaches law at the University of the District of Columbia. He says tourism has been a big bright spot as Puerto Rico defaults on loans and restructures its finances, but it can only do so much.
Tourism only represents between 5% and 7% of our gross domestic product, and obviously that sector alone won't be sufficient to actually jumpstart the Puerto Rico economy as a whole.
Puerto Rico's governor was in Washington today. He talked about the more than 500,000 residents who will lose health care unless Congress steps in. On the field in Los Angeles, the Puerto Rican baseball team just hopes to pull out one more victory for its people, the Boricuas. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We here in California find ourselves with an interesting problem. We've had one of the wettest winters on record, more than twice as much rain and snow as we get in an average year. And it's made all the more interesting since we were 6 years deep into a historic drought. So all of this water could be really useful if we could just hold on to it. Marketplace's Jed Kim has more on that.
Big dam projects are darn big deals. It took years and a crazy drought to get a yes vote on $7.1 billion for California water projects, including storage like dams. Chris Orach is a spokesman for the California Water Commission. Even with the funding finally in place, he says water storage won't get built right away.
We have to do our due diligence. We have to make sure that we pick the best projects that we get the best return of investment on.
New projects face a whole lot of environmental impact studies and engineering reviews. And new dams might be really expensive without being nearly as effective as the big ones we already have. J.R. DeShazo teaches public policy at UCLA.
Most of the great sites have been taken. And so the sites that still exist, they might be small, they might be oddly shaped or represent certain engineering designs that are particularly tricky at this stage.
better, DeShazo says, to focus on filling up California's groundwater supply. There are giant reservoirs underfoot that could be fed with stormwater. But we're years away from that capability. Peter Glick is co-founder of the Pacific Institute, a water think tank. He says while California takes years to build more water storage, the fastest, best bet is simple. Learn to use less.
Growing more food with less water by improving our irrigation technologies in the agricultural sector, by making the cities more efficient with better washing machines and toilets and dishwashers.
He says it would have been great for California to catch and store all that extra storm water, but we didn't. And now it's in the ocean. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
We're spending a lot of time in and around Erie, Pennsylvania this year for a series we're calling The Big Promise, how the Trump administration's policies and election promises are playing out around the country with Trump supporters and opponents alike. Like a lot of struggling manufacturing towns, Erie has seen a big population decline over the years, while at the same time it has welcomed immigrants and refugees, which now make up about 20% of the city's population. Erie needs them to help its economy grow, and as Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports, the city's immigrants depend on each other for the very same thing.
This is what Saad El Badawi's day sounds like.
Hey, Alzado, let me grab a
Al? Yes, Shana. The Toyota Corolla, yes.
El Badawi, everyone calls him Al, has been fixing cars in his small shop in Erie since
1998, May of 1998. We open up here.
He was in his 30s then, a new Iraqi refugee living with his two brothers. He says to open the garage, he needed three things.
The money and the language. We live in the United States, you have to have the language. And the help from other people.
The money came from his job as a truck driver. The language from classes. And the help, the electrician next door sent El Badawi his first customers. Now, two decades later, he's married with three children. And he's the one offering the help.
The guy, Erie Auto, on the right-hand side by 16th Street, he used to work here. The guy on 12th Street, he used to work here. The guy on 26th Street, he used to work here.
Iraqis own more than 10 auto shops in Erie, and many of them have learned under El Badawi, and not just how to change tires, but how to start a business, where to buy a hoist, which permits and licenses you need. And because it can be hard for immigrants to borrow money, they lean on each other for that, too.
No interest, no fee, no nothing, you know, just when you finish, you don't need stuff, like a year, year and a half, and bring her over.
I go looking for one of the guys El Badawi helped out, only I wind up in the wrong garage, also owned by an Iraqi immigrant. Of course, he knows where to send me.
He's not far away.
Just that way? Keep going straight?
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Wael El-Esadi is 38 years old. He says on slow days like this one...
Can't even find anything to do just to get your day to pass by. On some days, no. You can't even itch your head because of how busy you are.
El-Esadi initially resettled in San Diego. Then he moved to Erie. Then back to San Diego. Then back to Erie. He says he likes it here. It's quiet, small.
Although sometimes I've been missing San Diego. It's the big freeways, the nice weather... Other than that, I'm okay.
Erie City is home to about 3,000 Iraqis, and it's known for welcoming immigrants. With a declining population, the city needs them. The surrounding county, though, supported Donald Trump. El-Esadi says the administration's push to keep refugees and immigrants out.
I hate it. As it is, they've been through so much. And being banned from coming to U.S. and get the help they need, that's terrible.
But El-Esadi doesn't want to dwell on that. He'd rather direct me to another friend who has a new butcher shop and grocery store not too far from here. News in Arabic blares from the TV. Two mounted deer heads guard the walls. And in the back, co-owner Haider El-Kofi shaves pieces of meat off a large spit. He also left San Diego for Erie.
Everything is easy right here. They want to rent the home just $500, $600, you know. Cheap, very cheap.
And he just expanded his business. Actually, Saad El Badawi built the addition. You remember him, the mechanic we met at the beginning?
He's a good guy, he's a nice guy, very nice, like my friend.
A friend who gave him a solid deal, a 75% discount. Back at his garage, El Badawi tells me,
somebody gonna want to open that store, doesn't matter who. So I'd rather to see somebody I know to be there, you know, so I can lean on if I need something. That's how it works, you know. I help you, you help me.
And the network keeps getting stronger. In Erie, Pennsylvania, I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
We've collected all of our Erie coverage, including the live show we did there the day before Inauguration Day, at marketplace.org. If you go out for dinner, say, and you decide to have margarita, you are almost certainly partaking of a Mexican import. Virtually all the tequila in this country comes from Mexico, which means that if the president follows through on his promise to renegotiate or scrap NAFTA, happy hour might be a little bit different. Javier Martinez is the president and CEO of Martinez Brands. They're based in Pasadena, California, spirits importer. So we took a swing by where he cited tequila's NAFTA clauses to me chapter and verse.
You know, Annex 313 says, you know, that tequila for the U.S. is whatever Mexico says tequila is. So that lowered the regulation. You just tell the U.S., I'm going to bring this tequila. Here's my label. The approval is in 10 days. Something like that. Very easy. So that really, the NAFTA facilitated the whole procedure. Regulation. You know, Mr. Trump is saying about regulation. Well, NAFTA is going to kill that.
Well, talk to me then, because the president has said he wants to renegotiate or get rid of NAFTA. Mm-hmm. He wants to put taxes on products coming into this country. What's that going to do to Martinez?
Well, first of all, you know, the uncertainty that he has introduced into the business. Before any decision, legal decision is affecting my business, my mind has already affected.
You're seeing it already? Or you're feeling it already?
Yeah, I'm feeling it.
Yeah.
On top of my business, I am actually currently the president of an association of Mexican entrepreneurs, Mexican business owners here in Southern California who have businesses. And all of us, we're worried, you know, because we put on hold business plans. Like in my case, you know, I was going to bring wines from Mexico. The logic was, you know, they accepted our beer, they accepted our tequila, you know, wine should be the next
thing. That's good. I like that, right? Right. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we have the plans, we put together the plan. I said, shall we do it or shall we wait until it is more clear? You know, it's going to be a tariff of 20% or what is going to be the thing?
Yeah, but waiting for you, a guy who runs a business, time is money.
Exactly. But, you know, you have to make the decision. You run the risk and you continue as if nothing is going to happen or you slow down.
So what are you going to do?
I'm slowing down. Obviously.
Are you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I need more clarity.
The Mexican government has not been strong, shall we say, in standing up to Mr. Trump. Do you look to them, to President Peña Nieto, for support?
Well, I think the sense is that in the business community, we feel that the government has not been up to the challenge. We need to be stronger, firmer. And they have taken this approach of, you know, we're going to be cautious. We don't want to upset anyone. We want to negotiate. Yeah, but you're not playing with the same rules that Washington is playing. So you got to understand that. So that's our only complaint.
I'm not a tequila guy, but if I was going to start drinking tequila, give me your best recommendation.
Ooh, this is my luxury brand.
Oh, all right. Okay, all right. All right, we're going to go luxury brand tequila? All right.
Paqui.
Paqui. Which now, is, what's the difference between silver and gold tequila? And what, I mean,
well, how many types of tequila you think there are overall? Not brands, not types.
Take a pick. Two, silver and gold. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm 10 different types.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, most of the people send in is silver, reposado, and añejo.
Okay.
But in fact, there's more than that. So it's
all right. So this is paqui.
This is paqui, which means to be happy in Aztec, in Nahuatl language.
How much is this going to cost me in the liquor store?
$30, you know, $29.99.
Well, there you go.
Absolutely.
Right. Mr. Martinez, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. Yeah, no, I'm not a tequila guy. You can check out all of our NAFTA coverage online, marketplace.org. Today, a quiz of sorts. You draw graphs of how you think the economy has changed since NAFTA was signed. We'll tell you how you did. Give it a try. It is, I will tell you, harder than you think. This final note on the way out today, in which events in the global economy have been interrupted by what's being called a terrorist incident, the car attacks and stabbings in London today. Up in Scotland this afternoon, members of the Scottish Parliament had been in the middle of voting on whether to have another independence referendum as British Prime Minister Theresa May gets ready to start the clock on Brexit next week. Scottish MPs said they would table the referendum motion out of respect for the victims and then take it up again at a later date. Okay, we're done. The Dow off 6 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 27 points, about a half percent. S&P 500 up as well, 4 points, about 0.2%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.